Welcome to Scrappy ABM, your source for groundbreaking approaches that don't break the bank. ABM shouldn't cost $200K in tech to even get started. So if you want to get started with ABM or make your program even better without investing a massive amount of money, you're in the right place. Each week, we'll hear from the brightest minds in the marketing world who are redefining ABM, achieving incredible results with untraditional methods, limited resources, and a whole lot of creativity. This isn't a show about how much money you can spend on fancy tech or overhyped tools. Instead, it's about celebrating creative problem solving and the scrappiness it takes to get ABM right. We'll dive into how these marketing leaders built robust ABM strategies with limited resources, revealing the actionable insights that led to their biggest wins. So if you're a marketer ready to challenge the status quo and build a scalable, efficient, effective marketing strategy, Scrappy ABM is the show for you. So if you're ready to discover ABM strategies that are lean, impactful, and utterly transformative, let's dive into this episode. Welcome to Scrappy ABM. This is your practical podcast with playbooks that don't break the bank. Today, I'm joined by Bryn Hazard, who is the head of marketing over at Field. Super excited to dig into this. She was brought into Field specifically to build the ABM program on a budget, on a global scale, using more of a content-led program that is short-form, value-packed content. So speaking of packed content, I'm excited to unpack this playbook with you guys today and excited to learn from Bryn. So Bryn, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So what I want to dig into is, for starters, again, if this is what you were primarily brought in to Field to actually build, like, I'm curious, so much of building ABM is like upfront expectation setting and make sure everybody's on the same page. Sounds like you actually had to start doing that in your interview process. So I'm curious, like, how did you actually get buy-in on the front end to build this kind of an ABM program? Like, how did you pitch this internally?
So I was really straightforward. And one of the things that was a big talking point for us was the importance of, I would say, not only like sales and marketing alignment, but alignment with product, alignment with the executive suite and with the board, and alignment with customer success. I think so much sometimes about ABM is they're like, okay, you're going to work closely with the sales team, or you're going to take a list of 20 accounts and go for it. And I think it's way more collaborative, because I knew that it would be a really big messaging push. We're a small company looking at a global market with a lot of diversity in who really could benefit from our product across huge sectors, right? Like construction and utilities. So I knew that we'd have to have alignment across the entire org. And that was something we talked a lot about in the interview process.
So I'm curious, as you were then having these conversations to actually drive that alignment, there are so many different ways that people try to build that alignment. I'm curious, like, how did you start to, one, assess current state from an alignment perspective, then two, identify this is how we'll drive it once I'm actually in the organization?
I think that I was pretty lucky in the sense of the leadership team that was already in place had really good energy. So I think that us as a group now are a lot of over communicators. And that was something I was looking for myself in terms of a culture fit, right? Because I think when it comes to bringing in an ABM strategy, you need to be with a group of people who just innately over communicate. Versus coming into something where it's so siloed, I think that presents its own set of challenges. So I think I lucked out where I got that feeling right away. And then when we kicked off, one of the ways that I think we drove alignment together was really aligning on that kind of initial market research and treating that like a priority one exercise. Yeah, they had their maybe like ICP, but it was a little bit all over the place. And we really needed to sit down and map it out and say, okay, if we're going to focus, then here's the types of customers that we like working with. Here's where we've been seeing better velocity. We had to ask like all of those hard questions and really map that out and challenge the assumptions that maybe already existed before building the marketing team.
Yeah. So I don't know that we've even talked that much about a lot of customer research in the show thus far, but I love the call out of you had a good feeling about the team. You thought that there was good alignment internally. It was almost like a trust but validate kind of approach of, I trust everything that you're saying is likely accurate, but if I'm going to place my own career bet here, like, I want to also validate
that we're on the right page, we're on the right track. Like, we know who our ICP is, we know what they are struggling with, we know how to position our product as the solution. So I'm just curious, again, as you're doing that customer research, like, how did you go about executing that early as you're stepping into the role?
Yeah, we did have some existing customer data. I wouldn't say, I think that's one of those challenges, right? Where sometimes with early stage startup, you have this early set of data and you have to make some assumptions off of that no matter what. And that is like the gamble, but took the time, mapped out everything that we knew to be true or that we did have data on. So these types of personas, the areas of this market, what were some of the nuances that came into play? When they did become a customer, how did that go? Was it enjoyable? Was it actually like a good product fit? Did it create tension? Did it end up becoming expensive for us on the product development side? So the extended leadership team, sales, founders, those were the types of questions we asked almost in a workshop style setting. And that I think took about, we did it very quickly because it was a priority one, which is why I think setting expectations is so important. We were able to get to a good landscape view to make decisions off of, I would even say within the first 2 weeks of me coming on board.
Wow, that's awesome. Okay, so now, again, through the interview process, we are assessing alignment, we get a good feeling about it. You get in, you do the customer research, you validate. These are the product market fit type customers that we're already seeing early wins with and the right feelings around. So now we've got essentially an intended audience that we can start to actually build programs around. I'm curious, as you then started to go and build the program, like, what did the tech stack look like that you could actually go and build a program with?
Yeah, so it was minimal. We actually didn't have anything in terms of marketing tools. I think we had the most basic marketing package for HubSpot when I joined on. So we did direct a little bit of spend to up that contract, and we have just been very HubSpot heavy. And then like LinkedIn Sales Nav, trying to see what we could do from a marketing perspective with the sales tools that were already in place, which I actually think are so useful. And you have to be a little bit scrappy, not to pun off the name of this podcast, but you have to be a little bit scrappy. What is our tech stack and can I use the tools that are there, even if they're not marketed as marketing tools in a sense?
It's a lot of how we think through it is just, especially getting a program off the ground, all the tools will give you access to probably some form of a distribution channel. And if it's an outbound sales tool, that is just a distribution channel. Like, yes, you can use it in your ABM program. Is it technically a sales tool? Yeah, but ABM is the intersection for marketing sales anyway. So it's just a tool that you can use to get in front of your audience. So I love that call out of not just looking at the MarTech stack, but the whole like marketing sales tech stack to then understand what are the available tools that we got to go build a program.
Yep, absolutely.
So as you then, you've got your audience, you now have an understanding of the tools that you've got at your disposal. It's very heavy HubSpot. So again, we're talking some basic marketing automation, maybe some chat flows, like landing pages, like again, the basics of modern day marketing. How did you then start to segment out your audiences so that you could go build some different campaigns? Because again, we're talking global scale here. So we haven't even gotten into audience segmentation.
We had to do some of the technical elbow grease work of segmenting ourselves within HubSpot. So I think we also set ourselves up in a really good spot where I say to my team, we put all of our eggs in the HubSpot basket, as in the sales team is using it, the marketing team is using it, the customer success team is using it. And that I think has made segmentation really easy. So we knew where we wanted to focus. And then it was really that ops. We're going to go in and we're going to start building the workflows, the automations, so that we have these lists so that we can run targeting a bit more easily. So we were a little bit lucky in that regard where there's not a lot of communication between, let's say, like the CRM and the marketing automation tool that you have to figure out. We actually don't have dedicated marketing ops. And so my team is taking on that technical side as well, which not every marketer has like the deepest ops background. So that has been fun, a fun challenge.
Yeah. So what I'm curious about is just driving that adoption for everybody to then live in HubSpot. Because I know for a lot of teams, they want to have that kind of centralized tool, but it's difficult to actually be able to make that kind of change. I'm curious, like, how did you help to drive that adoption so that then you could more easily have that segmentation down the road?
Yeah, in terms of driving that adoption, I actually think what worked the best was highlighting the wins. So I think, especially in early stage startup, when you're moving so quickly, there's often not a lot of times to reflect and be like, this is such a great data that highlights how great the customer success team is doing. Or look at BDR activity, like tracking up and aligning with the campaigns. And oh, this turned into we noticed some activity on the website and BDR activated on that. And that was all manual, but good job, everyone. So we actually went with the highlight the wins through the
Yeah.
lens of the tool. And that is, I think, the biggest thing that drove adoption.
That's super smart. The last interview that we just did was they had a What's in it for you internal newsletter. That's, hey, Mark, we need all this stuff. By the way, sales, this is what's in it for you. And that was how they drove adoption for their ABM program. I think that's just super smart to say, hey, you did these things. And as a result, this is what is now happening. Please keep going. And just that constant feedback loop of this is working. Please get, keep going.
Oh, totally. And it's a trust the data situation, right? I think because we were highlighting those things with the hard back data, people tend to believe in that and they want to contribute to those positive trends or those positive signals. And I think from a culture perspective, it helps motivate people to continue rowing in the same direction, which is so important.
Yeah. Couple other just questions that are I'm thinking through as it relates to more the audience side of things. Again, we've got the segmentation, we've got the teams now using the tools to, again, keep the data up to date. I'm just curious, like, how did you get the initial input information that then fueled the larger program? Did you have a data enrichment source? Like, how did you actually get that initial target account list after you'd done the customer research?
Yeah, so we did a lot of data enrichment. And
Okay.
then a lot of it too is we have had some kind of scrappy event presence to just grow the conversations we were having. So our sales team in particular was very boots on the ground so that we could quickly build up a store of data. We're also operating in kind of a unique market segment. We're an AI company that is targeting sectors like utilities, construction, even areas of oil and gas, highways, the list goes on and on. Now, these types of target personas are not hanging out as much online or on LinkedIn as, let's say, you or I were. So we also have a very scrappy, just commercial team in general who has really driven a lot of that data capture. And then I think data enrichment came on as a secondary piece, but it is a boots on the ground move.
Okay. No, that's just helpful for people to understand. And I love a good event activation thought process of like, how do we actually take all people we're meeting, boots on the ground, all these different meetings, and actually tracking that and keeping that stored? I think that's something that just a lot of people are not necessarily accustomed to. So that's all helpful context. When we get into content, again, we alluded to it at the very beginning, but you guys were creating short form content that was essentially like a lot of customer testimonials. So I'm curious. Like, how did you get the initial content input that then could create all these short form content pieces?
Yeah, so we spend a lot of time talking to our customers. I think that helps, number one, because you build that relationship and you can more easily churn out content and they know who marketing is. I think so many times, or I've worked at places where marketing kind of lags behind in being involved in the customer relationship building element. And when you're thinking about ABM and you're prioritizing messaging development and you don't have a ton of budget and you don't have unlimited bandwidth and things need to happen quickly, I think the biggest value from like a messaging and content thing is actual real life stories. So to me, it made sense to invest the team time in actually having customer conversations where we could churn out really short form pieces of content where it's a snippet of value, like an actual number that could also be flagged by our customer success team, or it's a quick quote that we grab. So we treat it as both ongoing relationship building as well as content development. And we find that our customers actually do want to have those conversations, but we have to ask and we have to be noisy about it because they're busy, right? So we dedicate some time to just get in front of them.
So again, what I'm hearing is you guys just talk to the customers a lot, you build great relationships, and then when it comes time to ask, it's a pretty easy ask at that point. I'm curious what you mean when you say you've got to be noisy about it. Functionally, what does that mean?
I think that there's a fine line between spamming a customer and being noisy. So my team will even go on site to our customers' work sites and build those relationships and just be present. I think it's not always being like the keyboard warrior, but actually thinking about it in the sense of, hey, marketing should have some face time with our contacts, just like account directors should, just like customer success should. And we actually prioritize that human element and having marketing in that relationship circle. So that's what I mean about making noise versus me shooting off a cold email to a contact at a customer that I've never really talked to before, never had a Zoom call. We find that doesn't work. It's, we have to give ourselves that opportunity to be like the human, make that human connection.
Yeah. I love that. So again, you're deep relationships, and it's not just virtual, like you're actually going and meeting your customers in person and actually developing real in-person relationships. And then when you go to ask for that content, are you doing that on site or are you doing that virtually through Zoom? Like how, what's the actual content capture component?
This is where I think it is super scrappy because it's just wherever we see the moment. And this might make me sound a little bit like a corporate hippie, but I always tell my team to read the vibe. So it definitely is about like looking for that opportunity, whether you're in person, you're on a Zoom call, you're hearing customer success talk about something, it's like constantly keeping one ear open for the right time to ask instead of, like, we haven't really boxed ourselves into a formal process in that regard, just because I think it's worked better for us to ask when it feels right.
Yeah, it's helpful. There's no need to overprocess something, but it sounds like, again, it almost has become a culture piece, it sounds like, of we deliver such value for our customers that when we see our customers seeing what we've delivered for them, we want to ask them if we can capture that moment with them. And it's not a process. It's not like an if-then chart. It's just a piece of the culture. That is, we value our customers. When our customers value us back, we want to capture those moments.
Yep, absolutely.
Love it. And then again, once that moment is captured, I'm sure you've got like a team or a freelancer that you've used to post, produce, and create all those content assets.
Yeah, I think from our side, we build a lot of that in-house, which is why we've been prioritizing short-form content because we can do it quickly. We don't have to do a lot of spend. And then we took some time, stood up Canva, and we do a lot of the design elements ourselves so that we don't always have to outsource something or wait on a really long design backlog. So that was another area where we have to bring that do-it-ourself mentality. And short-form content, I think, is a really great fit if you're looking to get a lot out, you're talking to a lot of different personas, you really have to be able to do it yourself with a small team and a small budget.
Again, I love it. I don't know if you're familiar with Isaac Ware over at User Gems, but he has nailed this process where they're doing 100 to 200 one-to-one ABM programs on a monthly basis. And they've got their process down and they do most of it in-house. They've got a couple of VAs that they work with to do some really basic Canva stuff. But like once you've nailed down the process and you understand these are the assets that we need, it doesn't have to be overly complicated. It's probably just a Canva template. We just change out a couple of faces and a couple of headlines and titles, and then we just ship it again. I love that simplified design side of things because otherwise you're right. Like I've been working with a designer for our website and it's taken 4 months to get landing page design back. And it, in a scrappy context, like that just does not work. As far as you mentioned, like minimal spend. So you created these content assets, like how are you effectively distributing to these different audiences?
Yeah, we are allocating budget monthly for what I would call different or traditional kind of digital campaigns. So obviously we are spending some to try and drive traffic to our website or trying to drive targets to convert, drive them through various elements of, I guess you could say like a content education funnel, but we definitely have a small budget there. So the budget is what the budget is, which roughly we're looking at around $5,000 a month that we're spending digitally, where I think we actually get more coverage is our great relationship with the BDR team. So our business development representatives, we're super close to them. We're talking to them multiple times a week. And they, when they are on board, are such a megaphone where they see the short form content come out. We tell them, hey, this is perfect for this type of persona within this segment. And they are being really scrappy and sending it out. Hey, did you see this? I was thinking of you. They get playful with it as well. And we have seen so much traction from that just by giving them ammo and different ways to talk to their target audience. And in a way that's free in terms of a digital campaign. Yeah.
And again, I love the call out of the partnership with the BDR team. So many of the like early scrappy programs we're helping our clients build are largely just like good content with good BDR processes that result in good meetings on the calendar. And just like that lockstep ability to actually equip your BDRs and your SDRs with more than, hey, do you want to book a call? Hey, by the way, do you want to book a call? By the way, do you want to book a call? And it's more like actual education along the way. I love the content-led outbound program. That's fantastic. Last couple of questions before we wrap up. Any unexpected roadblocks that you guys experience as you're building out this program? I think I just saw PTSD flash before your eyes of probably a couple unexpected roadblocks.
There's always going to be some. I think, especially if you're coming in and building a marketing team plus a strategy from scratch, I think there's always things that you don't anticipate in terms of, oh, there's a barrier to entry, even with HubSpot, right? Like I, throughout my career, have used HubSpot, love HubSpot, would not call myself the primary HubSpot expert in the field. So there's always going to be learning curves where the entire team has to up level on it together. And then we're a global team who's small and trying to tackle a global market. And there's language barriers that you have to think through. And then there's also time zone differences where you need that collaborative atmosphere between marketing and sales. But when the head of marketing is in the US and the majority of the sales team primarily in the beginning was in the UK, that was a challenge, right? So how do we stay collaborative when we get 5-6 maximum hours of overlap together? I'm waking up at 6, they're staying on till 7, right? So those were some of the challenges that we had to overcome. And we're still adjusting to that because as we scale, those things will continue to change, right?
Yeah. When I worked with a UK-based team, it was definitely an adjustment because normally I've been East Coast time. So if I'm working with US-based team members, I'm generally like the first person to send an email. Whereas when you work with a UK-based team or like a global team, you generally wake up to 15 Slacks and 20 emails. And then like you spend the first part of your day getting out of the inbox and then actually starting your day. And especially when you're building an ABM program and you're trying to get that cross-functional alignment, I can almost imagine every single day you probably woke up to a flurry of questions and thoughts and comments. And then the other challenge is always like when there's been meetings that have happened in their UK morning and they made decisions around things. And then we've got to like get back up to speed on their new decisions and maybe course correct on some of the decisions. And the time zone component, I think, is one of the not as talked about over barriers to overcome when building out an ABM program. So I appreciate you calling it out.
Absolutely. I think our motto is progress over perfection. Obviously, we want everything to be great, but we also prioritize speed and needing that collaboration. So I think innately we have adopted that as our motto internally, and it's done really good things for us. Because when you're starting off, you are going to get out there, you're going to hit roadblocks, you're going to make mistakes, you're going to be waking up at 6 a.m. to 14 fires. And so you've got to come in with that flexibility mindset.
Yeah, I love it. All right, last couple of questions for you. And as far as building out this program, again, it sounds like great audience identification, great partnership with BDRs, and like really great short form value packed content. So I'm just curious, what were some of the results you guys started to see as you built out this program?
Yes. So there's a few different elements. We stood this up and relatively quickly prioritizing those couple of areas. We still have a ways to go, but we did see that have an immediate impact on our pipeline results. So within that first quarter, we actually doubled revenue. We just saw more meetings coming in with the right people. And then those deals tended to turn into revenue more quickly than just like fishing for any bite. So I think that focus was the biggest reason why we had an impact on revenue that was somewhat measurable right away.
That's incredible. I'm sure everybody was very happy to see doubled revenue in the first quarter. That is like the dream situation for every marketer.
Yeah, gives a good platform to even loftier goals. So keeping the pressure high for sure.
Yeah. All right, last question for you before we close it out. If somebody is looking at starting an ABM program, like what other thoughts or advice would you give them that you think is absolutely essential before somebody gets into to building this out?
I think that my advice would be don't sleep on the importance of messaging. I think one of the most almost daunting parts of what we talked about is you look at doing that early kind of project and having to bring everyone in to agree on, we're going to focus on these specific areas and we're going to start with this messaging. And in those types of exercises, you have quite a few different voices and a few different cooks in the kitchen, and it can make the messaging exercise seem one, kind of time consuming, and two, a little bit frustrating. But if you dedicate that early sort of first thing I'm going to do is lay this self out, validate some of my assumptions and get some messaging in place, it really streamlines everything else that you start going after in terms of content development, creation. Oh, how are we going to stand up these digital campaigns? I think messaging is the core, and I try to keep that as my truth in a sense.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Before I got into all this ABM stuff, I was a story brand messaging guide, and like all I did was messaging work. And the simplest thing is just if people don't understand the words that you're saying, it doesn't matter how it's distributed to them, or that if it doesn't resonate with them, they're not going to click on it, they're not going to engage, they're not going to buy. So who you're going after and how you message them, I think, are the two most important things. The rest of its distribution, you can figure that out. You can figure out how to track it. If you don't know who you're going after, why you're going after them, and how to message them, the rest all falls apart.
Yep.
Awesome. Bryn, if people want to find out more about you, where can they find you?
Yeah, they can look me up on LinkedIn, Bryn Hazard. I think I have a somewhat unique name, so should be able to find, might be the only Bryn Hazard on LinkedIn. So that is the best place. Yep.
I love it. Again, Bryn, thank you so much for joining me today. This has been Scrappy ABM. We'll see you in the next one.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Scrappy ABM. If you enjoyed this week's episode, go ahead and give us a follow so that you don't miss a single episode. We drop every single Monday so that you can start your week off right. And if you're looking for additional great content just like this, go check out scrappyabm.com. We're building a library of frameworks, guides, templates, processes, and tools so you have everything that you need to build a low-budget, high-impact, scrappy program. Again, thank you for listening to this episode of Scrappy ABM. This has been your host, Nathan Cosby, and we look forward to seeing you in the next one.